Zone. That's the latest. I'm Tanya.
This is Talking Books
on RNIB Connect Radio.
Every instinct that I possess cries out against it. It's wrong. It's all wrong. I swear that it's wrong.
That's Peter Cushing reading The Return of Sherlock Holmes by Arthur Conan Doyle, which continues today on Talking Books.
Talking Books with Robert Kirkwood.
But first on today's show...
In this time of uncertainty, I thought I'd take a quick virtual wander through the shelves of the RNIB Talking Books library to find some books that may help. First up, The Ultimate Happiness Prescription by Deepak Chopra.
The purpose of life is the expansion of happiness. Happiness is the goal of every other goal. Most people are under the impression that happiness comes from becoming successful, accumulating wealth, being healthy and having good relationships. There is certainly enormous social pressure to believe that these accomplishments are the same as achieving happiness. However, this is a mistake.
With words like depression and recession in the air, the author underlines the importance of keeping an eye on the positive aspects of life and finding ways to experience joy no matter what is happening. This book explains how to maintain an optimistic outlook and experience the benefits of having a happy heart and soul, no matter what the circumstances. It's read for you by the brilliant Bob Rollett.
Success, wealth, good health and nurturing relationships are byproducts of happiness, not the cause. When you are happy, you are more likely to make choices that lead to all these things. The reverse isn't true. Everyone has observed people who are deeply unhappy even after they have attained incredible wealth and success. Good health can be taken for granted and abused. And even the happiest family can find its happiness ruined by a sudden crisis. Unhappy people are not successful, and no amount of money and achievement will change the equation. So, let's shift our gaze beyond external indications to inner happiness, which we all want to attain, and yet which remains elusive.
Bob Rollett, reading from The Ultimate Happiness Prescription by Deepak Chopra. It's a short book. It only lasts for 3 hours and 3 minutes. Also in the library is 59 Seconds by Professor Richard Wiseman. Think a little, change a lot.
Discover why even thinking about going to the gym can help keep you in shape. Learn how pot plants can make you more creative. Find out why putting a pencil between your teeth instantly makes you feel happier.
In 59 Seconds, psychologist Professor Richard Wiseman presents a fresh approach to change that helps people achieve their aims and ambitions in minutes, not months. From mood to memory, persuasion to procrastination, and resilience to relationships, Wiseman outlines the research supporting this new science of rapid change and describes how these quick and quirky techniques can be incorporated into everyday life.
People behave in highly predictable ways when they experience certain emotions and thoughts. When they are sad, they cry. When they are happy, they smile. When they agree, they nod their heads. So far, no surprises. But according to an area of research known as proprioceptive psychology, the same process also works in reverse. Get people to behave in a certain way, and you cause them to feel certain emotions and have certain thoughts. The idea was initially controversial, but was fortunately supported by a series of compelling experiments. In one, now classic, study, two groups of people were asked to add up a list of numbers. During the task, one group were asked to furrow their brows, or, as the researchers put it, contract their corrugator muscle, while the others were requested to adopt a slight grin, extend their zygomaticus muscle. This simple act of facial contortion had a surprising effect on participants' ratings of how hard they found the number-adding task, with the frowning participants convinced that they had expended far more effort than the grinning group. In a different study, participants were asked to concentrate on various products moving across a large computer screen, and then indicate whether the items appealed to them. Some of the items moved vertically, causing the participants to nod their heads while watching, while others moved horizontally, resulting in a side-to-side head movement. Participants preferred vertically moving products without being aware that their yes and no head movements had played a key role in their decisions. Exactly the same idea applies to happiness. People smile when they are happy, but also feel happier because they are smiling. The effect even works whether people are aware of the smile or not. In the 1980s, Fritz Strack and his colleagues asked two groups of people to judge how funny they found Gary Larson's Far Side cartoons and rate how happy they felt under one of two rather bizarre circumstances. One group were asked to hold a pencil between their teeth, but to ensure that it did not touch their lips. The other group supported the end of the pencil with their lips, but not their teeth. Without realizing it, those in the teeth-only condition had forced the lower part of their faces into a smile, while those in the lips-only condition had made themselves frown. The results revealed that the participants tended to experience the emotion associated with their expressions. Those who had their faces forced into a smile felt happier and found the Far Side cartoons much funnier than those who were forced to frown. Other work has demonstrated that this increase in happiness does not drain away the moment people cease smiling. It lingers on, affecting many aspects of their behaviour, including interacting with others in a more positive way and being more likely to remember happy life events. The message from this type of work is simple. If you want to cheer yourself up, behave like a happy person.
Robin Houston, narrating 59 Seconds, Think a Little, Change a Lot by Professor Richard Wiseman, which lasts for 8 hours and 38 minutes. And finally, if you're stuck at home at the moment, why not learn about the history of that domicile with At Home, a short history of private life by Bill Bryson.
I don't know how many hours of my school years were spent studying the Missouri Compromise or the War of the Roses, but it was vastly more than I was ever encouraged or allowed to give to the history of eating, sleeping, having sex, or endeavouring to be amused.
Bill Bryson considers what most of history really consists of, centuries upon centuries of people quietly going about their daily business. He started a journey through his own house, an old rectory in Norfolk, wandering from room to room, considering how the ordinary things in life came to be. Along the way, he allowed himself digressions on the history of everything from architecture to epidemics, from food preservation to the discovery of electricity, and from crinolines to toilets.
So I thought it might be interesting, for the length of a book, to consider the ordinary things in life, to notice them for once, and treat them as if they were important too. Looking around my house, I was startled and a little appalled to realize how little I knew about the domestic world around me. Sitting at the kitchen table one afternoon, playing idly with the salt and pepper shakers, it occurred to me that I had absolutely no idea why, out of all the spices in the world, we have such an abiding attachment to those too. Why not pepper and cardamom, say, or salt and cinnamon? And why do forks have four tines and not three or five? There must be reasons for these things. Dressing, I wondered why all my suit jackets have a row of pointless buttons on every sleeve. I heard a reference on the radio to someone paying for room and board, and realized that when people talk about room and board, I have no idea what the board is that they are talking about. Suddenly, the house seemed a place of mystery to me. So I formed the idea to make a journey around it, to wander from room to room and consider how each is featured in the evolution of private life. The bathroom would be a history of hygiene, the kitchen of cooking, the bedroom of sex and death and sleeping, and so on. I would write a history of the world without leaving home.
At Home, A Short History of Private Life is written and read by Bill Bryson, and it lasts for 16 hours, 33 minutes. The RNIB Library is free to join for anyone with a print disability, and it can all be done online. Just head to Reading Services, that's all one word, readingservices.rnib.org.uk, or you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Ten years after Sherlock Holmes fell to his death off the Reichenbach Falls, locked in the arms of Professor Moriarty, Arthur Conan Doyle was persuaded to pen further adventures featuring his brilliant detective. Many thought the new tales wouldn't live up to the past Sherlock Holmes stories, but Doyle had lost none of his cunning or panache, providing Holmes with a sparkling set of mysteries to solve and challenging new adversaries to defeat, including the despicable Charles Augustus Milverton. This classic, The Return of Sherlock Holmes, was recorded by RNIB in 1971 and is read for you by Peter Cushing.
The 12th story, The Abbey Grange. It was on a bitterly cold and frosty morning during the winter of 97 that I was wakened by a tugging at my shoulder. It was Holmes. The candle in his hand shone upon his eager, stooping face and told me at a glance that something was amiss. "Come, Watson, come," he cried. "The game is afoot. Not a word. Into your clothes and come." 10 minutes later, we were both in a cab and rattling through the silent streets on our way to Charing Cross Station. The first faint winter's dawn was beginning to appear, and we could dimly see the occasional figure of an early workman as he passed us, blurred and indistinct in the opalescent London reek. Holmes nestled in silence into his heavy coat, and I was glad to do the same, for the air was most bitter, and neither of us had broken our fast. It was not until we had consumed some hot tea at the station and taken our places in the Kentish train that we were sufficiently thawed, he to speak and I to listen. Holmes drew a note from his pocket and read it aloud. "Abbey Grange, Marsham, Kent, 3:30 a.m. My dear Mr. Holmes, I shall be very glad of your immediate assistance in what promises to be a most remarkable case. It is something quite in your line. Except for releasing the lady, I will see that everything is kept exactly as I have found it, but I beg you not to lose an instant, as it is difficult to leave Sir Eustace there. Yours faithfully, Stanley Hopkins." Hopkins has called me in 7 times, and on each occasion his summons has been entirely justified, said Holmes. I fancy that every one of his cases has found its way into your collection, and I must admit, Watson, that you have some power of selection which atones for much which I deplore in your narratives. Your fatal habit of looking at everything from the point of view of a story instead of as a scientific exercise has ruined what might have been an instructive and even classical series of demonstrations. You slur over work of the utmost finesse and delicacy in order to dwell upon sensational details which may excite but cannot possibly instruct the reader.
Why do you not write them yourself? I said with some bitterness.
I will, my dear Watson, I will. At present I am, as you know, fairly busy, but I propose to devote my declining years to the composition of a textbook which shall focus the whole art of detection into one volume. Our present research appears to be a case of murder.
You think this Sir Eustace is dead, then?
I should say so. Hopkins's writing shows considerable agitation, and he is not an emotional man. Yes, I gather there has been violence, and that the body is left for our inspection. A mere suicide would not have caused him to send for me. As to the release of the lady, it would appear that she has been locked in her room during the tragedy. We are moving in high life, Watson. Crackling paper, E.B. monogram, coat of arms, picturesque address. I think the friend Hopkins will live up to his reputation, and that we shall have an interesting morning. The crime was committed before 12 last night.
Well, how can you possibly tell?
By an inspection of the trains and by reckoning the time. The local police had to be called in. They had to communicate with Scotland Yard. Hopkins had to go out, and he, in turn, had to send for me. All that makes a fair night's work. Well, here we are at Chislehurst Station, and we shall soon set our doubts at rest. A drive of a couple of miles through narrow country lanes brought us to a park gate, which was opened for us by an old lodge-keeper, whose haggard face bore the reflection of some great disaster. The avenue ran through a noble park, between lines of ancient elms, and ended in a low, widespread house, pillared in front, after the fashion of Palladio. The central part was evidently of a great age, and shrouded in ivy, but the large windows showed that modern changes had been carried out, and one wing of the house appeared to be entirely new. The youthful figure and alert, eager face of Inspector Stanley Hopkins confronted us in the open doorway.
"I'm very glad you could come, Mr. Holmes, and you too, Dr. Watson. But indeed, if I had my time over again, I should not have troubled you, for since the lady has come to herself, she has given so clear an account of the affair that there is not much left for us to do. You remember that Lewisham gang of burglars?"
"What, the three Randalls?"
"Exactly. The father and two sons. It's their work. I have not a doubt of it. They did a job at Sydenham a fortnight ago, and were seen and described. Rather cool to do another so soon and so near. But it is they, beyond all doubt. It's a hanging matter this time."
"Sir Eustace is dead, then?"
"Yes. His head was knocked in with his own poker."
"Sir Eustace Brackenstall, the driver tells me."
"Exactly. One of the richest men in Kent. Lady Brackenstall is in the morning room. Poor lady, she has had a most dreadful experience. She seemed half dead when I first saw her. I think you had best see her and hear her account of the facts. Then we will examine the dining room together."
Lady Brackenstall was no ordinary person. Seldom have I seen so graceful a figure, so womanly a presence, and so beautiful a face. She was a blonde, golden-haired, blue-eyed, and would, no doubt, have had the perfect complexion which goes with such colouring, had not her recent experience left her drawn and haggard. Her sufferings were physical as well as mental, for over one eye rose a hideous plum-coloured swelling, which her maid, a tall, austere woman, was bathing assiduously with vinegar and water. The lady lay back exhausted upon a couch, but her quick, observant gaze as we entered the room, and the alert expression of her beautiful features, showed that neither her wits nor her courage had been shaken by her terrible experience. She was enveloped in a loose dressing-gown of blue and silver, but a black sequin-covered dinner dress was hung up on the couch beside her.
"I have told you all that happened, Mr. Hopkins," she said wearily. "Could you not repeat it for me? Well, if you think it necessary, I will tell these gentlemen what occurred. Have you been in the dining room yet?"
"I thought they'd better hear your ladyship's story first."
"I shall be glad when you can arrange matters. It is horrible to me to think of him still lying there."
She shuddered and buried her face for a moment in her hands. As she did so, the loose gown fell back from her forearm. Holmes uttered an exclamation. "You have other injuries, madam. What is this?" 2 vivid red spots stood out on one of the white rounded limbs. She hastily covered it.
"It is nothing. It has no connection with the hideous business of last night. If you and your friend will sit down, I will tell you all I can. I am the wife of Sir Eustace Brackenstall. I have been married about a year. I suppose that it is no use my attempting to conceal that our marriage has not been a happy one. I fear that all our neighbours would tell you that, even if I were to attempt to deny it. Perhaps the fault may be partly mine. I was brought up in the freer, less conventional atmosphere of South Australia, and this English life, with its proprieties and its primness, is not congenial to me. But the main reason lies in the one fact which is notorious to everyone, and that is that Sir Eustace was a confirmed drunkard. To be with such a man for an hour is unpleasant. Can you imagine what it means for a sensitive and high-spirited woman to be tied to him for day and night? It is a sacrilege, a crime, a villainy to hold that such a marriage is binding. I say that these monstrous laws of yours will bring a curse upon the land. Heaven will not let such wickedness endure."
For an instant she sat up, her cheeks flushed, and her eyes blazing from under the terrible mark upon her brow. Then the strong, soothing hand of the austere maid drew her head down onto the cushion, and the wild anger died away into passionate sobbing. At last, she continued.
"I will tell you about last night. You are aware, perhaps, that in this house all servants sleep in the modern wing. This central block is made up of the dwelling rooms, with the maids behind and our bedroom above. My maid, Teresa, sleeps above my room. There is no one else, and no sound could alarm those who are in the farther wing. This must have been well known to the robbers, or they would not have acted as they did. Sir Eustace retired about 10:30. The servants had already gone to their quarters. Only my maid was up, and she had remained in her room at the top of the house until I needed her services. I sat until 11 in this room, absorbed in a book. Then I walked round to see that all was right before I went upstairs. It was my custom to do this myself, for, as I have explained, Sir Eustace was not always to be trusted. I went into the kitchen, the butler's pantry, the gun room, the billiard room, the drawing room, and finally, the dining room. As I approached the window, which is covered with thick curtains, I suddenly felt the wind blow up on my face and realized that it was open. I flung the curtain aside and found myself face to face with a broad-shouldered elderly man who had just stepped into the room. The window is a long French one, which really forms a door leading to the lawn. I held my bedroom candle lit in my hand, and by its light, behind the first man, I saw 2 others who were in the act of entering. I stepped back, but the fellow was on me in an instant. He caught me first by the wrist and then by the throat. I opened my mouth to scream, but he struck me a savage blow with his fist over the eye and felled me to the ground. I must have been unconscious for a few minutes, for when I came to myself, I found that they had torn down the bell rope and had secured me tightly to the oaken chair which stands at the head of the dining-room table. I was so firmly bound that I could not move, and a handkerchief round my mouth prevented me from uttering any sound. It was at this instant that my unfortunate husband entered the room. He had evidently heard some suspicious sounds, and he came prepared for such a scene as he found.
He was dressed in his shirt and trousers, with his favourite blackthorn cudgel in his hand. He rushed at one of the burglars, but another, it was the elderly one, stooped, picked the poker out of the grate, and struck him a terrible blow as he passed. He fell without a groan, and never moved again. I fainted once more, but again it could only have been a very few minutes during which I was insensible. When I opened my eyes, I found that they had collected the silver from the sideboard, and they had drawn a bottle of wine which stood there. Each of them had a glass in his hand. I have already told you, have I not, that one was elderly with a beard, and the others young, hairless lads. They might have been a father with his two sons. They talked together in whispers. Then they came over and made sure that I was still securely bound. Finally, they withdrew, closing the window after them. It was quite a quarter of an hour before I got my mouth free. When I did, so my screams brought the maid to my assistance. The other servants were soon alarmed, and we sent for the local police, who instantly communicated with London. Now that is really all I can tell you, gentlemen, and I trust that it will not be necessary for me to go over so painful a story again.
Any questions, Mr. Holmes? Asked Hopkins. I will not impose any further tax upon Lady Brackenstall's patience and time, said Holmes. Before I go into the dining room, I should be glad to hear your experience. He looked at the maid.
I saw them in before ever they came into the house, said she. As I sat by my bedroom window, I saw three men in the moonlight, down by the lodge gate yonder, but I thought nothing of it at the time. It was more than an hour after that I heard my mistress scream, and down I ran to find her poor lamb, just as she says, and him on the floor with his blood and brains over the room. It was enough to drive a woman out of her wits, tied there, and her very dress spotted with him. But she never wanted courage, did Miss Mary Fraser of Adelaide, and Lady Brackenstall of Abbey Grange hasn't learned new ways. You've questioned her long enough, you gentlemen, and now she's coming to her own room, just with her old Teresa, and get the rest that she badly needs.
With a motherly tenderness, the gaunt woman put her arm round her mistress and led her from the room. She's been with her all her life, said Hopkins, nursed her as a baby, and came with her to England when they first left Australia 18 months ago. Teresa Wright is her name, and the kind of maid you don't pick up nowadays. This way, Mr. Holmes, if you please. The keen interest had passed out of Holmes's expressive face, and I knew that with the mystery or the charm of the case had departed. There still remained an arrest to be effected, but what were these commonplace rogues that he should soil his hands with them? An abstruse and learned specialist who finds that he has been called in for a case of measles, would experience something of the annoyance which I read in my friend's eyes. Yet the scene in the dining-room of the Abbey Grange was sufficiently strange to arrest his attention and to recall his waning interest. It was a very large and high chamber, with carved oak ceiling, oaken panelling, and a fine array of deer's heads and ancient weapons around the walls. At the farther end from the door was the high French window of which we had heard. Three smaller windows on the right-hand side filled the apartment with cold winter sunshine. On the left was a large, deep fireplace with a massive, overhanging oak mantelpiece. Beside the fireplace was a heavy oaken chair with arms and crossbars at the bottom. In and out through the open woodwork was woven a crimson cord, which was secured at each side to the crosspiece below. In releasing the lady, the cord had been slipped off her, but the knots with which it had been secured still remained. These details only struck our attention afterwards, for our thoughts were entirely absorbed by the terrible object which lay spread upon the tiger-skin hearthrug in front of the fire.
This is Talking Books. Our featured book is The Return of Sherlock Holmes, as read by Peter Cushing. And we'll have more after this.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss. For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free Talking Books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999. Open 8 to 8 weekdays and 9 to 5 on Saturdays. Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
During this coronavirus crisis, RNIB's helpline is incredibly busy. People with sight loss are struggling with food shopping, loneliness, getting accessible information, and much more. For many, the helpline is also a lifeline, and that's why every call needs to be answered. If you feel able to, please consider donating to RNIB's appeal today to help everyone stay safe and connected. Just text CONNECT to 70688 to donate £10 now. Thank you.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
RNIB Talking Books have always had the privilege of working with some great narrators, including many actors from the stage and silver screen. Sir John Gielgud is a member of the short list of entertainers with the distinction of having won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar and a Tony Award. In Backward Glances, he offers many portraits of his theatrical friends and acquaintances, including Edith Evans, Charles Laughton, Ralph Richardson and Vivian Leigh, as well as recollections of his own life in and out of the theatre.
I first saw her act when I was a schoolboy towards the end of the 1914 war. And then she was playing supporting parts in various long-forgotten plays as spinsters, companions, and even mothers in white wigs. The dragonfly had not yet emerged from the cocoon. The eccentric William Pearl had discovered her and cast her as Cressida after rehearsing her first in several male parts in the same production. And it was he who encouraged her to leave the Belgravia hat shop in which she had been working and become a professional actress.
That's Sir John Gielgud reading Backward Glances back in 1993. For more information on this and other celebrity narrators, head to the Talking Book pages of www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now more from The Return of Sherlock Holmes, as read by Peter Cushing.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
It was the body of a tall, well-made man, about 40 years of age. He lay upon his back, his face upturned, with his white teeth grinning through his short black beard. His two clenched hands were raised above his head, and a heavy blackthorn stick lay across them. His dark, handsome, aquiline features were convulsed into a spasm of vindictive hatred, which had set his dead face in a terribly fiendish expression. He had evidently been in his bed when the alarm had broken out, for he wore a foppish embroidered nightshirt, and his bare feet projected from his trousers. His head was horribly injured, and the whole room bore witness to the savage ferocity of the blow which had struck him down. Beside him lay the heavy poker, bent into a curve by the concussion. Holmes examined both it and the indescribable wreck which it had wrought. "He must have been a powerful man, this Elder Randall," he remarked. "Yes," said Hopkins. "I have some record of the fellow, and he is a rough customer. You should have no difficulty in getting him. Not the slightest. We have been on the lookout for him, and there was some idea that he'd got away to America. Now that we know the gang are here, I don't see how they can escape. We have the news at every seaport already, and a reward will be offered before evening. But what beats me is how they could have done so mad a thing, knowing that the lady would describe them, and that we could not fail to recognise the description." "Exactly. One would have expected that they would have silenced Lady Brackenstall as well." "They may not have realised," I suggested, "that she had recovered from her faint." "That is likely enough. If she seemed to be senseless, they would not take her life. What about this poor fellow, Hopkins? I seem to have heard some queer stories about him." He was a good-hearted man when he was sober, but a perfect fiend when he was drunk, or rather, when he was half-drunk, for he seldom really went the whole way. The devil seemed to be in him at such times, and he was capable of anything. From what I hear, in spite of all his wealth and his title, he very nearly came our way once or twice. There was a scandal about his drenching a dog with petroleum and setting it on fire, her ladyship's dog, to make the matter worse, and that was only hushed up with difficulty. Then he threw a decanter at that maid, Teresa Wright. There was trouble about that. On the whole, and between ourselves, it'll be a brighter house without him. What are you looking at now? Holmes was down on his knees, examining with great attention the knots upon the red cord with which the lady had been secured. Then he carefully scrutinised the broken and frayed end, where it had snapped off when the burglar had dragged it down. When this was pulled down, the bell in the kitchen must have rung loudly, he remarked. No one could hear it. The kitchen stands right at the back of the house. How did the burglar know no one would hear it? How dare he pull at a bell rope in that reckless fashion? Exactly, Mr. Holmes, exactly. You put the very question which I have asked myself again and again. There can be no doubt that this fellow must have known the house and its habits. He must have perfectly understood that the servants would all be in bed at that comparatively early hour, and that no one could possibly hear a bell ring in the kitchen. Therefore, he must have been in close league with one of the servants. Surely that is evident. But there are 8 servants, and all of good character. Other things being equal, said Holmes, one would suspect the one at whose head the master threw a decanter. And yet that would involve treachery towards the mistress to whom this woman seems devoted. Well, well, the point is a minor one, and when you have Randall, you will probably have no difficulty in securing his accomplices. The lady's story certainly seems to be corroborated, if it needed corroboration, by every detail which we see before us. He walked to the French window and threw it open. There are no signs here, but the ground is iron-hard, and one would not expect them. I see that these candles on the mantelpiece have been lighted. Yes, it was by their light, and that of the lady's bedroom candle, that the burglars saw their way about. And what did they take? Well, they did not take much, only 6 articles of plate off the sideboard. Lady Brackenstall thinks that they were themselves so disturbed by the death of Sir Eustace that they did not ransack the house as they would otherwise have done. No doubt that is true. And yet they drank some wine, I understand, to steady their own nerves. Exactly. These 3 glasses upon the sideboard have been untouched, I suppose. Yes, and the bottle stands as they left it. Let us look at it. Halloa, halloa! What is this? The 3 glasses were grouped together, all of them tinged with wine, and one of them containing some dregs of bee's wing. The bottle stood near them, 2/3 full, and beside it lay a long, deeply stained cork. Its appearance and the dust upon the bottle showed that it was no common vintage which the murderers had enjoyed. A change came over Holmes's manner. He had lost his listless expression, and again I saw an alert light of interest in his keen, deep-set eyes. He raised the cork and examined it minutely. "How did they draw it?" he asked. Hopkins pointed to a half-open drawer. In it lay some table linen and a large corkscrew. "Did Lady Brackenstall say that screw was used?" "No. You remember that she was senseless at the moment when the bottle was opened." "Quite so. As a matter of fact, that screw was not used. This bottle was opened by a pocket screw, probably contained in a knife and not more than 1.5 inches long. If you examine the top of the cork, you will observe that the screw was driven in 3 times before the cork was extracted. It has never been transfixed. This long screw would have transfixed it and drawn it with a single pull. When you catch this fellow, you will find that he has one of those multiplex knives in his possession." "Excellent," said Hopkins. "But these glasses do puzzle me, I confess. Lady Brackenstall actually saw the three men drinking, did she not? Yes, she was quite clear about that. Then there is an end of it. What more is to be said? And yet you must admit that the three glasses are very remarkable, Hopkins. What? You see nothing remarkable? Well, well, let it pass. Perhaps when a man has special knowledge and special powers, like my own, it rather encourages him to seek a complex explanation when a simpler one is at hand. Of course, it must be a mere chance about the glasses. Well, good morning, Hopkins. I don't see that I can be of any more use to you, and you appear to have your case very clear. You will let me know when Randall is arrested, and any further developments which may occur. I trust that I shall soon have to congratulate you upon a successful conclusion. Come, Watson, I fancy that we may employ ourselves more profitably at home. During our return journey, I could see by Holmes's face that he was much puzzled by something which he had observed. Every now and then, by an effort, he would throw off the impression and talk as if the matter were clear, but then his doubts would settle down upon him again, and his knitted brows and abstracted eyes would show that his thoughts had gone back once more to the great dining-room of the Abbey Grange, in which this midnight tragedy had been enacted. At last, by a sudden impulse, just as our train was crawling out of a suburban station, he sprang onto the platform and pulled me out after him. "Excuse me, my dear fellow," said he, as we watched the rear carriages of our train disappear round a curve. "I am sorry to make you the victim of what may seem a mere whim, but on my life, Watson, I simply can't leave that case in this condition. Every instinct that I possess cries out against it. It's wrong. It's all wrong. I swear that it's wrong. And yet the lady's story was complete. The maid's corroboration was sufficient. The detail was fairly exact. What have I to put against that? Three wine glasses, that is all. But if I had not taken things for granted, if I had examined everything with the care which I should have shown, had we approached the case de novo, and had no cut-and-dried story to warp my mind, would I not then have found something more definite to go upon? Of course I should. Sit down on this bench, Watson, until a train for Chislehurst arrives, and allow me to lay the evidence before you, imploring you, in the first instance, to dismiss from your mind the idea that anything which the maid or mistress may have said must necessarily be true. The lady's charming personality must not be permitted to warp our judgment. Surely there are details in her story which, if we look at it in cold blood, would excite our suspicion. These burglars made a considerable haul at Sydenham a fortnight ago. Some have counted them, and their appearance was in the papers, and would naturally occur to anyone who wished to invent a story in which imaginary robbers should play a part. As a matter of fact, burglars who have done a good stroke of business are, as a rule, only too glad to enjoy the proceeds in peace and quiet, without embarking on another perilous undertaking. Again, it is unusual for burglars to operate at so early an hour. It is unusual for burglars to strike a lady to prevent her screaming, since one would imagine that was a sure way to make her scream. It is unusual for them to commit murder when their numbers are sufficient to overpower one man. It is unusual for them to be content with a limited plunder when there is so much more within their reach. And finally, I should say that it was very unusual for such men to leave a bottle half empty.
You're listening to Talking Books, and we'll have more from the return of Sherlock Holmes in a moment.
Hello there, I'm Jonathan Hackett, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for 15 years. One of my favourite books was Bravo 2-0 by Andy McNab. It's about an SAS team that gets dropped in Iraq to carry out a very dangerous mission during the first Gulf War. And of course this mission goes disastrously and tragically wrong.
Within hours of Iraqi troops and armour rolling across the border with Kuwait at 0200 local time on August the 2nd, 1990, the regiment was preparing itself for desert operations.
It's a very, very exciting book, and it's populated with all sorts of accents. There are a variety. I mean, there's a South African, a Scot, a Brummie, a Cockney, an Aussie. I mean, there's a whole host of them, and it was quite a challenge, particularly around the campfire, so to speak, when they were all contributing to or engaged in a conversation. So it was quite challenging, but a very, very enjoyable book and a very exciting book and a very disturbing book.
There were shouts all along the line. See anything your end yet? Come on, let's get this done!
A second APC with a turret-mounted gun opened fire all along the area. It's not nice to know you're up against armour and vehicles with infantry on board. All you are is a foot patrol and these anonymous things are crushing relentlessly towards you. You know they carry infantry. You know the driver's in front and the gunner's up top and he's trying to look through his prism and it's difficult for him and he's sweating away up there, getting thrown about trying to aim. But all you can see is this thing coming screaming towards you and it looks so anonymous and monster-like, magnified 10 times suddenly because you realise it's aiming at you. They look so impersonal. They leave destruction in their wake. It's you against them. You're an ant, and you're scared. The APC nearest me cracked off more rounds, firing wildly. One burst stitched the ground about 10 metres in front of me. In the British Army, you're taught how to react when the enemy opens fire. You dash to make yourself a hard target. You get down. You crawl into a fire position. Find the enemy. Set your sights at the range and fire. Reaction to effective enemy fire, it's called. Your instincts compel you to get down and make yourself as small as possible and wait for it all to end. The rational side of your brain is telling you what you should be doing, which is getting up and looking to see what's going on so you can start fighting. There's no point just lying there because you're going to die anyway. The emotional side is saying, sod that, stay there, maybe it'll all go away. But you know it's not going to and that something has to be done.
I really love the service because of what it provides for blind and partially sighted people. So I love the job as a narrator because of the opportunity to quite literally tell stories. It's great fun, and personally, when you think that it's actually going to help and give enjoyment to other people, then that's the real point of it all.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now more from Peter Cushing, narrating The Return of Sherlock Holmes.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
How do all these unusuals strike you, Watson? Their cumulative effect is certainly considerable, and yet each of them is quite possible in itself. The most unusual thing of all, as it seems to me, is that the lady should be tied to the chair. Well, I'm not so sure about that, Watson, for it is evident that they must either kill her or else secure her in such a way that she could not give immediate notice of their escape. But at any rate, I have shown, have I not, that there is a certain element of improbability about the lady's story. And now, on top of this, comes the incident of the wine glasses. What about the wine glasses? Can you see them in your mind's eye? I can see them clearly. We are told that 3 men drank from them. Does that strike you as likely? Why not? There was wine in each glass. Exactly. But there was bee's wing only in one glass. You must have noticed that fact. What does that suggest to your mind? The last glass filled would be the most likely to contain bee's wing. Not at all. The bottle was full of it, and it is inconceivable that the first 2 glasses were clear and the 3rd heavily charged with it. There are 2 possible explanations and only 2. 1 is that after the 2nd glass was filled, the bottle was violently agitated, and so the 3rd glass received the bee's wing. That does not appear probable. No, no. I am sure that I am right. What then do you suppose? That only 2 glasses were used, and that the dregs of both were poured into a third glass, so as to give the false impression that three people had been there. In that way, all the beeswing would be in the last glass, would it not? Yes, I am convinced that this is so. But if I have hit upon the true explanation of this one small phenomenon, then in an instant the case rises from the commonplace to the exceedingly remarkable, for it can only mean that Lady Brackenstall and her maid have deliberately lied to us, and not one word of their story is to be believed, that they have some very strong reason for covering the real criminal, and that we must construct our case for ourselves without any help from them. That is the mission which now lies before us, and here, Watson, is the Chislehurst train. The household of the Abbey Grange were much surprised at our return, but Sherlock Holmes, finding that Stanley Hopkins had gone off to report to headquarters, took possession of the dining room, locked the door upon the inside, and devoted himself for 2 hours to one of those minute and laborious investigations which formed the solid basis on which his brilliant edifices of deduction were reared. Seated in a corner, like an interested student who observes the demonstration of his professor, I followed every step of that remarkable research. The window, the curtains, the carpet, the chair, the rope, each in turn was minutely examined and duly pondered. The body of the unfortunate baronet had been removed, but all else remained as we had seen it in the morning. Then, to my astonishment, Holmes climbed up onto the massive mantelpiece. Far above his head hung the few inches of red cord, which was still attached to the wire. For a long time he gazed upwards at it, and then, in an attempt to get nearer to it, he rested his knee upon a wooden bracket on the wall. This brought his hand within a few inches of the broken end of the rope. But it was not this so much as the bracket itself which seemed to engage his attention. Finally, he sprang down with an ejaculation of satisfaction. "It's all right, Watson," said he. "We have got our case, one of the most remarkable in our collection. But dear me, how slow-witted I have been, and how nearly I have committed the blunder of my lifetime. Now I think that with a few missing links, my chain is almost complete." "You have got your men?" "Man, Watson, man. Only one, but a very formidable person. Strong as a lion, witness the blow which bent that poker. 6'3" in height, active as a squirrel, dexterous with his fingers. Finally, remarkably quick-witted, for this whole ingenious story is of his concoction. Yes, Watson, we have come upon the handiwork of a very remarkable individual. And yet, in that bell-rope, he has given us a clue which should not have left us a doubt."
"Where was the clue?"
"Well, if you were to pull down a bell-rope, Watson, where would you expect it to break? Surely at the spot where it is attached to the wire. Why should it break 3 inches from the top, as this one has done?"
"Because it is frayed there?"
"Exactly. This end, which we can examine, is frayed. He was cunning enough to do that with his knife. But the other end is not frayed. You could not observe that from here, but if you were on the mantelpiece, you would see that it is cut clean off without any mark of fraying whatever. You can reconstruct what occurred. The man needed the rope. He would not tear it down for fear of giving the alarm by ringing the bell. What did he do? He sprang up onto the mantelpiece, could not quite reach it, put his knee on the bracket, you will see the impression in the dust, and got his knife to bear upon the cord. I could not reach the place by at least 3 inches, from which I infer that he is at least 3 inches a bigger man than I. Look at that mark upon the seat of the oaken chair. What is it?"
"Blood."
"Undoubtedly it is blood. This alone puts the lady's story out of court. If she was seated on the chair when the crime was done, how comes that mark? No, no. She was placed in the chair after the death of her husband. I'll wager that the black dress shows a corresponding mark to this. We have not yet met our Waterloo, Watson, but this is our Marengo, for it begins in defeat and ends in victory. I should like now to have a few words with the nurse Teresa. We must be wary for a while if we are to get the information which we want. She was an interesting person, this stern Australian nurse. Taciturn, suspicious, ungracious. It took some time before Holmes's pleasant manner and frank acceptance of all that she said thawed her into a corresponding amiability. She did not attempt to conceal her hatred for her late employer. "Yes, sir. It is true that he threw the decanter at me. I heard him call my mistress a name, and I told him that he would not dare to speak so if her brother had been there. Then it was that he threw it at me. He might have thrown a dozen, if he had but left my bonny bird alone. He was forever ill-treating her, and she was too proud to complain. She would not even tell me all that he has done to her. She never told me of those marks on her arm that you saw this morning, but I know very well that they came from a stab with a hatpin. The sly fiend! Heaven forgive me that I should speak of him so now that he is dead, but a fiend he was, if ever one walked the earth. He was all honey when first we met him, only 18 months ago, and we both feel as if it were 18 years. She had only just arrived in London. Yes, it was her first voyage. She had never been from home before. He won her with his title and his money and his false London ways. If she made a mistake, she has paid for it, if ever a woman did. What month did we meet him? Well, I'll tell you, it was just after we arrived. We arrived in June, and it was July. They were married in January of last year. Yes, she is down in the morning room again, and I have no doubt that she will see you, but you must not ask too much of her, for she has gone through all the flesh and blood will stand.
And we'll have the conclusion of that tale tomorrow.